Chapter 15. I grew up in Cincinnati, Stuart McCowan told them. My father was a construction worker, but he was an alcoholic, so he wasn't always able to find work. Then when I was 15, he got drunk on a job and let a cable slip. He lost a leg, and after that, the only money we had coming in was from my mother. She did piecework for a company that made police uniforms, and what I could pick up in tips as a bag boy at Kroger's. My father always got after me about being so skinny and not very strong physically. He was a big, powerful man himself, had forearms half again as thick as Mike's there. After he lost the leg, everything got even worse between us. He couldn't stand the fact that, puny as I was at least whole. I had to carry things for him sometimes when he couldn't manage both an armload of packages and his crutches. He hated that. He really got to despise me after a while, and the drinking got worse. I left home when I was 18. That was in 1954. Went west, out to Seattle. I wasn't very strong, but my eyes and my hands were steady. I managed to find work at Boeing. Learned to machine tool some of the lighter aircraft parts, trim tabs and such. I met a girl out there, got married, had a couple of kids. It wasn't so bad. Then I had my accident in the spring of 63, the one I told you about. I'd been drinking a little myself, not like my dad used to, but a few beers on the way home from work and a shot or two once I got home, you know. And I was drunk when I hit that tree. Didn't come to for 8 weeks, and nothing was ever really the same after that. The concussion had screwed up my hand-eye coordination, so I couldn't hack it at work anymore. It seemed like everything was happening to me just the way it had to my dad. I started drinking more and yelling at my wife and kids. Finally, she just packed up and moved out, took the children with her. I lost the house not long after that. The bank foreclosed. I went back out on the road, started drifting, drinking. Did that for almost 25 years. One of the homeless, as they call it in the '80s, but I always knew what I was. Just a bum, a wino. I died in an alley in Detroit. Didn't even know how old I was then. I figured it out later, though. I was 52. And then I woke up, back in that same hospital bed, coming out of my coma, like I had just dreamed all those bad years. And for the longest time, I believed I actually had. I didn't remember much of them anyway, but I remembered enough, and pretty soon I could tell something really strange was going on. McCowan looked at Jeff with a sudden sparkle in those eyes that had gone weary with telling the story of his first life.
"You a baseball fan?"
he asked.
"Did you bet on the series that year?"
Jeff grinned back at him.
"I sure did."
"How much?"
"A lot. I'd been on Chateauguay in the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont first. Ran up a good stake."
"How much did you bet?"
Stuart persisted.
"Well, I had a partner then. Not another replayer, just somebody I knew from school, and between us we bet almost 125.
"'K?'
Jeff nodded, and McCowan let out a long, low whistle.
"You hit the big time early," Stuart said. "Me, all I could scrape up was a couple of $100. My wife damn near left home early when she found out. But not after I got back 20,000. She wasn't going any place then. So I kept on betting. Just the big things, the obvious ones. Heavyweight championships, Super Bowls, presidential elections. All the things that even a lifelong drunk couldn't have forgotten how they came out. I stopped drinking. Gave it up for good. Never have had so much as a beer since. Not in all the repeats I've been through. We moved into a big house in Alderwood Manor, up in Snohomish County, north of Seattle. Bought a nice boat, kept it in the Shilshoal Bay Marina. Used to cruise up and down Puget Sound every summer. Sometimes over to Victoria, B.C. Life of Riley, you know how it is. And then I started hearing from them.
From... Jeff left the question hanging. McCowan leaned forward in his chair, lowered his voice.
from the Antarians, the ones that are doing this.
How did they get in touch with you?
Pamela asked tentatively.
Through the television set, at first, usually during the news. That's how I came to find out. It was all a performance.
Jeff was growing increasingly edgy.
What was a performance?
Everything. All the stuff on the news, and the Antarians liked it so much, they just kept running it over and over again.
What was it that they liked?
Pamela asked, frowning.
The gory stuff? The shooting and killing, all that? Vietnam. Richard Speck, who did those nurses in Chicago. The Manson thing. Jonestown. And the terrorists. Jesus, yes, they really got off on the terrorists. Lode Airport, all the IRA bombings, the truck bomb at Marine headquarters in Beirut, on and on. They can't get enough of it.
Jeff and Pamela exchanged a quick look, a brief nod.
Why?
Jeff asked McCowan.
Why do the extraterrestrials like violence here on Earth so much?
Because they've grown weak themselves. They're the first to admit it. For all their power, controlling space and time, they're weak!
He slammed a thin fist down hard on the table, rattling the saucers and cups. Mike, the hefty attendant, looked over with raised eyebrows for a moment, but Jeff waved an okay signal and the man went back to his jigsaw puzzle.
None of them ever dies anymore,
Stuart went on impassionately.
And they've lost the killing genes. So there's no more war or murder where they come from. But the animal part of their brains still needs all that. At least vicariously, that's where we come in. We're their entertainment, like television or movies. And this segment of the 20th century is the best part, the most randomly bloody time of them all. So they keep playing it again and again. But the only people who know all this are the performers, the ones on stage, the repeaters. Manson is one of us, I know. I can see it in his eyes. And the Antarians have told me. Lee Harvey Oswald, too. And Nelson Bennett, that time he got to Kennedy first. Oh, there's a lot of us now.
Jeff kept his voice as calm, as kind as possible when he spoke again.
But what about you and me and Pamela?
He asked, looking to evoke some remnant of rationality in the man.
We haven't done all those terrible things, so why are we replaying or repeating?
I've done my share of appeasement,
McCowan stated proudly. Nobody can accuse me of slacking off there. Jeff felt suddenly ill and didn't want to ask the next question, the one that had to be asked.
You've used that word before, appeasement. What do you mean by it?
Why, it's our duty. All of us repeaters, we have to keep the Antarians from getting bored, or else they'll shut it all off, and then the world will be over. We have to appease them, entertain them, so they'll keep watching.
And, how have you done that yourself? Appease them?
I always start off with a little girl in Tacoma. I do her with a knife. That one's easy, and I never get caught. Then I move on to a couple of hookers in Portland, maybe Vancouver. Never too many close to home, but I travel a lot. Overseas sometimes, but mostly I do them here in the States. Hitchhikers in Texas, street kids in L.A. and San Francisco. Don't think I'll try Wisconsin again. I got caught here pretty early this time. But I'll be out in 4 or 5 years. They always say I'm crazy and I end up in one of these places, but I've gotten real good at fooling doctors and parole boards. I always get out eventually, and then I can go back to performing the appeasement.
Pamela leaned against the doorframe of the car, sobbing as they drove through the swirling snow.
"It's my fault,"
she cried, the tears flowing unchecked down her face.
"He said it was Starseed that gave him a sense of purpose. With everything I'd hoped to accomplish through that film, all I ended up doing was encouraging a mass murderer."
Jeff kept his hands tight on the wheel of the rented Plymouth, negotiating the icy road.
It wasn't just the movie. He had started killing long before that. From the very first replay, he was insane to begin with.
I don't know if it was that accident he had, or the shock of replaying, or a combination of the two. Maybe a lot of different factors. There's no way to tell, but for God's sake, don't blame yourself for what he's done. He killed a little girl. He keeps on killing her, stabbing her every time. I know, but it's not your fault, understand? I don't care whose fault it is. We've got to stop him.
How? Jeff asked, squinting to see the road through the enveloping sheets of snow.
Make sure he never gets out this time. Get to him next time before he starts killing.
If they decide he's cured, they're going to release him no matter what we say. Why should the doctors or the courts listen to us? Do we tell them we're replayers just like McCowan, only we're sane and he isn't? You know how far that would get us.
The next time
we go to the police in Seattle or Tacoma and tell them this solid citizen, with his expensive suburban house and his yacht, is about to start roaming the country, murdering people at random. It wouldn't work, Pamela. You know it wouldn't.
But we've got to do something,
she pleaded.
What should we do? Kill him? I couldn't do that. Neither could you.
She wept quietly, her eyes closed against the deathly whiteness of the winter storm.
We can't just sit back and let it happen,
she whispered at last. Jeff cautiously turned left onto the highway, heading back toward Madison.
I'm afraid we have to,
he said.
We have to just accept it.
How can you accept something like that?
She snapped.
Innocent people dying, being murdered by this maniac, when we know in advance that he's going to do it.
We've always accepted it, from the very beginning. Manson, Berkowitz, Gacy, Buono, and Bianchi. That sort of aimless savagery is part of this time period. We've become inured to it. I don't even remember half the names of all the serial killers who'll crop up over the next 20 years, do you?
Pamela was silent, her eyes red from crying, her teeth tightly clenched.
We haven't tried to intervene in all those other murders, have we?
Jeff asked.
It's never even occurred to us to do so, except that first time when I tried to stop the Kennedy assassination, and that was something of a very different order. We, not just you and me, but everyone in this society, we live with brutality, with haphazard death. We almost ignore it, except when it seems to threaten us directly. Worse, some people even find it entertaining, a vicarious thrill. That's 80% at least of what the news business is all about. Supplying America with its daily fix of tragedy, of other people's blood and torment. We are the Antarians of Stuart McCowan's demented fantasies. He and all the other subhuman butchers out there are indeed performers on a stage, but the gore-hungry audience is right here, not somewhere in outer space. And there's nothing you or I can ever do to change that or to stem even the smallest trickle of that blood tide. We simply do what we've always done and always will. Accept it, put it out of our minds as best we can, and go on with the rest of life. Get used to it, just as we do with all the other hopeless, inescapable pain.
The ad continued to draw responses, though none bore fruit. In 1970, they cut back on the number of publications in which it appeared. By the middle of the decade, it was being printed only once a month, in fewer than a dozen of the largest circulation newspapers and magazines. Their apartment on Bank Street in the West Village came to be dominated by rows of filing cabinets. Jeff and Pamela saved even the most vaguely promising replies to the ad, along with clippings from the voluminous stacks of periodicals they pored over daily in search of potential anachronisms that might indicate the handiwork of another replayer somewhere in the world. It was frequently hard to be certain, one way or the other, about whether some minor event or product or artwork had or had not existed in the previous replays. They had never before focused so intently on such minutiae. Many times they contacted inventors or entrepreneurs whose indifferently publicized creations were unfamiliar to them. Without exception, the apparent leads proved false. In March of 1979, Jeff and Pamela found this story in the Chicago Tribune. Wisconsin killer freed. Sane, say docs. Crossfield, Wisconsin, AP. Admitted mass murderer Stuart McCowan, declared not guilty by reason of insanity in the 1966 slayings of four young college women at a sorority house in Madison, was released today from the private mental institution where he had been held for the past 12 years. Dr. Joel Pfeiffer, director of the Crossfield home, said McCowan is fully recovered from his patterns of delusion and presents no threat to society at this point. McCowan was accused in the mutilation killings of the four co-eds after a witness identified his car as the one seen leaving the parking lot of the Kappa Gamma sorority house in the early morning hours of February 6, 1966, the day the bodies were discovered. Wisconsin State Police apprehended McCowan later that same day, outside the town of Chippewa Falls. They found a blood-stained ice pick, hacksaw, and other implements of torture in the trunk of his automobile. McCowan freely admitted having murdered the young women and claimed to have been instructed to do so by extraterrestrial beings. He further claimed to believe that he had been reincarnated a number of times and had carried out other killings in each of his previous lives. He was named as a suspect in similar multiple slayings in Minnesota and Idaho in 1964 and 1965, but his connection to those crimes was never established. On May 11, 1966, McCowan was judged incompetent to stand trial and was committed to the Wisconsin State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. He was transferred at his own expense to the Crossfield home in March 1967. Pamela pulled the rubber tubing tighter around Jeff's arm, showed him which vein to hit, and how to slide the hypodermic needle in with the bevel upward and the slender shaft parallel and lateral to the vein.
"What about psychological addiction, though?" he asked. "I know our bodies will be free of it when we come back, but won't we still crave the sensation?"
She shook her head as she watched him make the practice injection, the harmless saline solution flowing smoothly into the bulging blue vein in the crook of his elbow.
"Not if we only use it a couple of times," she said. "Wait until the morning of the 18th. Just do enough to keep you sedated. Then double the dosage to the amount I showed you and inject that a few minutes before 1 o'clock. You should be unconscious by the time cardiac arrest occurs."
Jeff emptied the syringe into his arm, waited a beat before he withdrew the needle. He tossed the hypodermic into the wastebasket, swabbed the injection site with a wad of cotton soaked in alcohol. Two matching leather kits lay on the coffee table. Each contained a supply of fresh sterile needles and syringes, a coiled length of rubber tubing, a small bottle of alcohol, a box of cotton wads, and four glass vials filled with pharmaceutical-quality heroin. It hadn't been difficult to obtain the drug and the equipment with which to use it. Jeff's stockbroker had recommended a reliable cocaine dealer, and the dealer was equally well-stocked for the growing upper-middle-class heroin trade. Jeff stared at the expensively tooled death kits, looked up at Pamela's face. There was a delicate tracery of fine lines across her forehead. The last time he had known her at this age, the tiny wrinkles had been at the corners of her mouth and eyes. Her forehead had been as smooth as when she was a girl. The difference between a lifetime of happiness and one of almost unrelieved anxiety was etched into the patterns of her skin.
"We didn't do a very good job of it, did we?" he said glumly.
She tried to smile, faltered, gave it up.
"No, I guess we didn't."
"Next time," he began,
and his voice trailed off. Pamela reached out to him, and they squeezed each other's hand.
"Next time," she said,
"we'll pay more attention to our own needs, day to day." He nodded.
"We kind of lost control this time. Just let it slip away.
I got carried away with the search for other replayers. It was kind of you to indulge me so, but
I wanted to succeed in that as much as you did," he interrupted,
bringing her hand to his lips.
"It was something we had to do. It's no one's fault it turned out the way it did."
"I suppose not. But looking back, those years seem so stagnant
so passive. We seldom even left New York for fear of missing the contact we kept waiting for.
Jeff pulled her to him, put his arms around her. Next time we take charge again, he promised, we'll be the ones who make things happen. For us.
They rocked together gently on the sofa, neither saying what was most deeply on their minds, that they had no way of knowing how long it would be before Pamela would rejoin him after this new death, or even if the next replay would enable them to be together again at all. The heroine's sleep was interrupted with shocking abruptness. Jeff found himself surrounded on all sides by cascading sheets of white-hot flame, a cylindrical Niagara of milky fire at whose core he was inexplicably suspended. At the same time, his ears were assaulted by the blaring trumpets and exaggerated harmonies of a mariachi band performing, at excruciating volume, Feliz Navidad. Jeff had no memory of having died this time, no recollection of the agony he had always felt with each stopping of his heart. The drug had served its anesthetic purpose, but it allowed him no easy transition from that dullard slumber to this startling and unknown environment. The new young body he now inhabited again had not a trace of the narcotic in its system, and he was forced to come fully awake without a moment's groggy respite. The encircling firefall and the music besieged his battered senses, held him in a terrifying limbo of disorientation. There was no light in this place, save from that burning cataract around him, but against its brilliant phosphorescence he now perceived the silhouettes of other people, sitting, standing, dancing. He himself was seated at a small table. There was an icy drink in his shaking hand. He sipped it, tasted the salty bite of a margarita. "Damn!" someone shouted in his ear above the clamor of the music. "Isn't that a sight? Wonder what it looks like from outside." Jeff set the drink down, turned to see who had spoken. In the white glow of the down-rushing flames, he could make out the sharp-boned features of Martin Bailey, his roommate from Emory. He looked around again, his eyes growing accustomed to the bizarrely incandescent lighting from all sides of the large room. It was a bar or nightclub. Laughing couples sat at dozens of other small tables. The mariachi band next to the dance floor was costumed in outrageous finery, and brightly colored piñatas in the shape of donkeys and bulls hung from the ceiling. Mexico City, Christmas Vacation, 1964. He had driven down here with Martin that year, on a spur-of-the-moment trip. Desert roads with mangy cattle roaming in the two-lane highway, mountain passes of blind curves, with Pemex gasoline trucks passing the Chevy in the cottony fog. A whorehouse in the Zona Rosa, the long climb up the stone steps of the Pyramid of the Sun. The tumbling radiance outside the windows of this place was a fireworks show, he realized. Streams of liquid pyrotechnics pouring from the roof of the hotel atop which the nightclub perched. Martin was right. It must be spectacular from the streets below. The hotel would look like a fiery needle, blazing 30 or 40 stories up into the city's nighttime sky. What was this? Christmas Eve? New Year's? Those were the nights for this sort of display in Mexico. Whichever, it was the end of 64, beginning of 65. He had lost another 14 months on this replay. As much now as Pamela had on her last one. God knows what that might mean for her this time, and for them. Martin grinned, gave him an exuberant, friendly punch on the shoulder. Yeah, they'd had a good time on this trip, Jeff remembered. Nothing had gone sour. It didn't seem then as if anything ever could go wrong in either of their lives. Good times today, good times ahead. That was how they had seen it. At least Jeff had managed to prevent his old friend's suicide each replay, whatever his own circumstances. even though he couldn't stop Martin from marrying badly and no longer had a multinational corporation where he could offer his old roommate a lifetime position, he'd always helped Martin avert eventual bankruptcy by setting him up with some excellent stocks early on. Which raised the subject of what Jeff was going to do for immediate cash himself. His old standby, the 63 World Series, was in the record books by now, and there weren't many other bets even approaching the short-term profitability of that one. The pro football season was already over, and they wouldn't start playing Super Bowls for another 2 years. If this were New Year's Eve, he might or might not have time to arrange a bet from Mexico City on Illinois over Washington in the Rose Bowl tomorrow. It was possible that he'd have to be satisfied for the time being with what he could eke out of the basketball schedule now underway, but he'd never be able to get any decent odds on the Boston Celtics, not in their eighth straight NBA championship season. The firefall outside the windows trickled to a sputtering halt, and the dim lights of the nightclub came back up as the band broke into Cielito Lindo. Martin was checking out a svelte blonde a couple of tables over, and he raised an eyebrow to ask if Jeff had any interest in her red-haired friend. The girls were tourists from the Netherlands, Jeff recalled. He and Martin wouldn't score, but they'd had spent, a pleasant enough evening drinking and dancing with the Dutch girls. Sure, he shrugged to Martin. Why not? As far as the money problem went, well, money didn't matter that much to him anyway, not at this point. All he needed was enough to keep him going for however long it took until Pamela showed up. From here on out, it was just a waiting game. Pam was stoned. She was flat out wrecked. This was really some killer weed Peter and Ellen had come up with. The best she had smoked since the stuff that guy had given her at the Electric Circus last month, and that had probably seemed better than it actually was because of all the strobes and the music and the fire eaters on the dance floor and everything. The music was great right now, too, she thought, as Clapton started that dynamite riff going into Sunshine of Your Love. She just wished the little portable stereo could play it louder, that was all. She curled her bare feet up under her thighs, leaned back against the big Peter Max poster that covered the wall behind her bed, and got into the back cover of the Disraeli Gears album. That eye was really something, with the flowers growing right out of its lashes and the names of the songs just barely visible over the white part and the iris. And God, there was another eye! The more you looked, it seemed like there was nothing but eyes. That was all you noticed. Even the flowers looked like they had eyes, slanted like a cat's eyes, or an oriental's. Hey, check this out, Peter called. She glanced up. He and Ellen were watching Lawrence Welk with the sound turned down. Pam stared at the black-and-white scene of old couples dancing, polka or something. And sure enough, it looked just like they were moving in time to the record. Then the picture switched to Welk, waving his little baton up and down, and she started laughing. Welk was keeping right to the beat, as if the old fart were conducting Cream on Dance the Night Away. "Come on, you guys, let's go down the road," Ellen insisted, bored with the television. "Everybody's going to be there tonight." She had been trying to get them motivated to get out of the room and make the trek to Adolph's for the past hour. She was right. It would be a good night at the college bar. There was a lot to celebrate. Earlier in the week, Eugene McCarthy had damn near beat Johnson in the New Hampshire primary. And just today, Bobby Kennedy had announced that he had changed his mind. He was going to run for the Democratic nomination after all. Pam put on her boots, grabbed a thick wool scarf and her old navy surplus pea jacket from the hook on the door. Ellen took her time negotiating the circular staircase leading down to the lobby. She had started tripping off on the old mansion-turned-dorms being Tara from Gone with the Wind. By the time they got outside, Peter had joined in the game. He wandered off into the adjoining formal garden and started declaiming lines real and imagined from the movie in a heavy, mock southern accent. But the March night was too biting to keep up the playful stoned pretense for long, and soon the three of them were crunching through the snow toward the warmly inviting wooden building at the edge of campus, across from the Annandale post office. Adolph's was packed with the usual Saturday night crowd. Everybody who hadn't gone to New York for the weekend ended up here sooner or later. It was the only bar within walking distance of the school, and the only one on this side of the Hudson where the shaggy, unconventionally dressed Bard students could relax and feel totally welcome. There was a serious town-gown conflict in the generally conservative region north of Poughkeepsie. The permanent residents, young and old, despised the flamboyant nonconformity of the Bard students' appearance and behavior, and told tales, many of them truer than they could ever imagine, Pam thought with amusement, of rampant drug use and sexual promiscuity on campus. Sometimes the young townie guys would come into Adolph's, drunk, trying to pick up hippie chicks. There weren't any townies in evidence tonight, Pam noted with relief, except for that one weird guy who had been hanging around campus all year. But he seemed okay. He was a loner and very quiet. He'd never given anybody any trouble. Sometimes she felt as if he were watching her, not quite following her around or anything, but purposely showing up a couple of times a week in some place where she'd probably be. The library, the gallery at the art department, here. He'd never bothered her, though. Never even spoke to her. Sometimes he'd smile and nod, and she'd kind of smile back a little, just enough to acknowledge that they recognized each other. Yeah, he was okay. He'd even be attractive if he let his hair grow. Sly and the Family Stone were on the jukebox, danced to the music, and the dance floor in the front room was packed. Pam and Ellen and Peter squirmed their way through the crowd, looking for a place to sit. Pam was still stoned. They had smoked another joint on the walk down from campus, and the colorfully raucous scene in the bar suddenly struck her as a painting, or a series of paintings. To highlight a twirling fringed vest here, a swirl of long black hair there, the faces and the bodies and the music and noise. Yes, she'd like to try to capture on canvas the sound of this pleasantly familiar place, translate it visually, the way that synthetic transformation so often happened in her mind when she was this stoned. She looked around the bar, picking out people and details of scenes, and her eyes focused on that strange guy she was always running into. "Hey," she said, nudging Ellen. "You know who I'd like to paint?"
"Who?"
"That guy over there." Ellen looked in the direction Pam had discreetly indicated.
"Which one?" "Oh, you don't mean that straight guy, do you? The townie?"
"Yeah, him. There's something about his eyes. They're, I don't know, it's like they're ancient or something. Like he's way older than he really is and has seen so much."
"Sure," Ellen said with pointed sarcasm. "He's probably some ex-Marine, and he's seen lots of dead babies and women he shot in Vietnam."
"You talking about the Tet Offensive again?" Peter asked.
"No, Pam's got the hots for some townie."
"Kinky," Peter laughed.
Pam blushed angrily.
"I never said any such thing. I just said he had interesting eyes and I'd like to paint them."
Dock of the Bay came on the jukebox, and most of the dancers found their way back to their tables. Pam wondered who had played the mournfully contemplative Otis Redding tune, such an ironic self-epitaph of the singer, who had died before the record was released. Maybe it was that guy with the strange eyes. It seemed like the kind of music he might be into.
"Wastin' time," Peter sang along with the record, then grinned mischievously.
He took off his watch, dropped it into the half-full pitcher of beer with a theatrical flourish.
"We drown time,"
he declared, and raised his glass, clinked it against the others.
"I hear Bobby's ahead," Ellen commented.
apropos of nothing when they had drunk the toast.
"Gets his grass from the same dealer who supplies the stones when they're over here."
They were on one of Peter's favorite topics now.
"They say R.J. Reynolds has secretly, patented? All the good brand names."
"Trademarked."
Right, trademarked. Acapulco Gold, Panama Red. The cigarette people have got all the good names just in case."
Pam listened to the familiar rumors, nodded with interest.
"I wonder what the packs would look like, and the ads."
"Paisley cartons," Ellen said with a smile.
"Get Hendrix to do the TV commercials," Peter put in.
They started cracking up, getting into one of those endless communal stoned laughing jags that Pam loved so much. She was laughing so hard, the tears were coming to her eyes. She was getting giddy, hyperventilating.
Where the hell was she this time? Pamela wondered. And why was she so dizzy?
She blinked away an inexplicable film of tears, took in the new environment.
Jesus Christ, it was Adolf's.
"Pam,"
Ellen asked, suddenly noticing that her friend had stopped laughing.
"You okay?"
"I'm fine,"
Pamela said, taking a long, slow breath.
"You're not freaking out or anything?"
"No." She closed her eyes, tried to concentrate, but her mind wouldn't stay still. It kept drifting. The music was extremely loud, and this place, even her clothes, reeked of... She was stoned, she realized. Usually had been when she went to Adolf's. Down the road, they used to call it. Ease on down, ease on down.
"Have another beer?"
Peter said, concern in his voice.
"You look weird. You sure you're all right?"
"I'm positive."
She hadn't become friends with Peter and Ellen until after winter field period of her freshman year. Peter had graduated, and Ellen had dropped out and moved to London with him when Pamela was a sophomore. That meant this had to be 1968 or 1969. A new record started playing on the jukebox. Linda Ronstadt singing "Different Drum." No, Pamela thought. Not just Linda Ronstadt. The Stone Ponies. "Keep it all straight," she told herself. "Reacclimate slowly. Don't let the marijuana in your brain make this more difficult than it already is. Don't try to make any decisions or even talk too much right now. Wait till you come down. Wait until..."
There he was. My God. Sitting not 20 feet away. Looking right at her.
Pamela gaped in disbelief at the incongruous, impossibly wonderful sight of Jeff Winston sitting quietly amid the youthful din of her old college hangout. She saw him register the change in her eyes, and he smiled a warm, slow smile of welcome and assurance.
"Hey, Pam," Ellen said, "how come you're crying? Listen, maybe we better get back to the dorm."
Pamela shook her head, put a reassuring hand on her friend's arm. Then she stood from the table and walked across the room, across the years, into Jeff's waiting embrace. "Tattooed lady," Jeff chuckled, kissing the pink rose on her inner thigh. "I don't remember that being there before."
"It's not a tattoo, it's a decal. They wash off."
"Do they lick off?"
he asked, looking up at her with a wicked gleam. She smiled.
"You're welcome to try."
"Maybe later,"
he said, sliding up to prop himself beside her on the pillows.
"I kind of enjoy you as a flower child."
"You would,"
she said, and poked him in the ribs.
"Pour us some more champagne."
He reached for the bottle of Mums on the bedside table, refilled their glasses.
"How did you know when I'd start replaying?"
Pamela asked.
"I didn't. I've been watching you for months. I rented the house here in Rhinebeck at the beginning of the school year, and I've been waiting ever since. It was frustrating, and I was starting to get impatient, but the time here helped me come to terms with some old memories. I used to live just up the river in one of the old estates when I was with Diane and my daughter Gretchen. I always thought I'd never be able to come back here, but you gave me a reason to, and I'm glad I did. Besides which, I enjoyed seeing you the way you really were in this time, originally.
She grimaced. I was a college hippie, leather fringe and tie-dye. I hope you never listened to me talking to my friends. I probably said far out a lot.
Jeff kissed the tip of her nose.
You were cute. Are cute,
he corrected, brushing her long, straight hair away from her face.
But I couldn't help imagining all these kids, 15 years from now, wearing 3-piece suits and driving BMWs to the office.
Not all of them, she said. Bart turned out a lot of writers, actors, musicians, and, she added with a rueful grin, my husband and I didn't have a BMW. We drove an Audi and a Mazda.
Point granted.
He smiled and took a sip of champagne. They lay together contentedly, but Jeff could see the gravity beneath her cheerful expression.
17 months,
he said.
What?
I lost 17 months this time. That's what you were wondering, wasn't it?
I'd been wanting to ask, she conceded. I couldn't help but wonder. My ski was up to... Well, this is March, you said? 68?
Jeff nodded.
3.5 years.
Counting from last time. It's 5 years off from the first few replays. Jesus. Next time I could...
He put a finger to her lips.
We're going to concentrate on this time, remember?
Of course I do,
she said, snuggling closer to him beneath the covers.
And I've been thinking about that,
he told her. I've had a while to consider it, and I think I've come up with a plan of sorts. She pulled her head back, looked at him with an interested frown.
What do you mean?
Well, first I thought about approaching the scientific community with all this, the National Science Foundation, some private research organization, whatever group might seem most appropriate, maybe the physics department at Princeton or MIT, somebody doing research on the nature of time.
They'd never believe us.
Exactly. That's been the stumbling block all along. And yet we've done our part to maintain that obstacle by remaining so secretive each time.
We've had to be discreet. People would think we're insane. Look at Stuart McCowan.
McCowan is insane. He's a killer. But it's no crime to make predictions of events. Nobody would lock us up for doing that. And once the things we predict have actually happened, we'll have proven our knowledge of the future. They'd have to listen to us. They'd know something real, unexplained but real, was going on.
How would we get in the front door to begin with, though?
Pamela objected.
No one at a place like MIT would even bother looking at any list of predictions we gave them. They'd lump us in with the UFO fanatics and the psychics the minute we told them what we had in mind.
That's just the point. We don't approach them. They come to us.
Why should... You're not making sense,
Pamela said, shaking her head in confusion.
We go public, Jeff explained.
Chapter 16. This time there was no need for the global saturation coverage they had employed with their previous ad, the small one with which they had hoped to attract the attention only of other replayers. Also, both the ambiguity and anonymity of that first notice were unnecessary for their present purpose. The New York Times refused to carry the one-time-only full-page ad, but it ran in the New York Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times. During the next 12 months, the U.S. nuclear submarine Scorpion will be lost at sea in late May. A major tragedy will disrupt the American presidential campaign in June. The assassin of Martin Luther King Jr. will be arrested outside the United States. Chief Justice Earl Warren will resign on June 26th and will be succeeded by Justice Abe Fortas. The Soviet Union will lead a Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia on August 21st. 15,000 people will be killed in an earthquake in Iran on the 1st of September. An unmanned Soviet spacecraft will circle the moon and be recovered in the Indian Ocean on September 22nd.
In October, there will be military coups in both Peru and Panama. Richard Nixon will narrowly defeat Hubert Humphrey for the presidency. Three American astronauts will orbit the moon and return safely to Earth during Christmas week. In January 1969, there will be an unsuccessful assassination attempt against Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev. A massive oil spill will contaminate the beaches of Southern California in February. French President Charles de Gaulle will resign at the end of next April. We will have no further comment to make on these new statements until May 1, 1969. We will meet with the news media on that date at a location to be announced 1 year from today. Jeff Winston and Pamela Phillips, New York, New York, April 19, 1968. Every seat of the large conference room they had rented at the New York Hilton was occupied, and those who could not find a chair milled impatiently in the aisles or at the sides of the room, trying to keep their feet from becoming entangled in the snaking microphone and television cables. At 3 p.m. precisely, Jeff and Pamela came into the room and stood together on the speaker's platform. She smiled nervously as the blinding lights for the TV cameras came on, and Jeff gave her hand an encouraging, unseen squeeze. From the moment they had walked in, the room was a hubbub of shouted questions, the reporters all vying at once for their attention. Jeff called several times for silence, finally got the level of noise down to a dim roar. "We'll answer all your questions," he told the assembled journalists. "But let's establish some kind of order here. Why don't we take the back row first, one question per person, left to right? Then we'll move to the next row in the same order." "What about the people who don't have seats?" cried one of the men at the side of the room. "Latecomers take their turns last, left side of the room first, back to front." "Now," Jeff said, pointing, "we'll take the first question from the lady in the blue dress. No need to identify yourselves, just ask anything you like." The woman stood, pen and pad in hand.
"The most obvious, how were you able to make such accurate predictions about such a wide range of events? Are you claiming to have psychic powers?"
Jeff took a deep breath, spoke as calmly as possible.
"One question at a time, please, but I'll answer both of those this once. No, we do not pretend to be psychic, as that term is commonly understood. Both Miss Phillips and I have been the beneficiaries, or the victims, of a recurring phenomenon that we initially found as difficult to believe as you undoubtedly will today. In brief, we are each reliving our own lives, or certain portions of them. We both died, will die, in October 1988, and have returned to life and subsequently died again several times over."
The noise that had greeted them as they entered the room was nothing compared to the pandemonium that ensued at this statement, and the overall derisive tone of the cacophony was unmistakable. One television crew shut off its lights and began packing away its equipment, and several reporters stalked out of the room in an insulted huff. But there were many others eager to take the vacated seats. Jeff signaled for quiet again, pointed to the next journalist in line for a question.
"This one's obvious, too," the portly, scowling man said. "How the hell do you expect any of us to believe that crap?"
Jeff maintained his composure, smiled reassuringly at Pamela, and calmly addressed the scornful crowd.
"I told you before that what we have to say will seem barely credible. I can only point to the complete validity of the predictions we published a year ago, which were already memories to us, and ask that you reserve judgment until you've heard us out. Are you going to make any more predictions today?" asked the next reporter. "Yes," Jeff said, and the uproar threatened to begin anew. "But only after we've answered all your other questions and feel that we've told everything we need to tell."
It took them almost an hour to give the essential, sketchy outline of their lives, who they had been originally, what they had done of note in each of their replays, how they came to know each other, the troubling fact of the accelerating skew. As previously agreed, they left out a great deal about their personal lives, as well as anything they felt might be dangerous or unwise to reveal. But then came the question they had known would be raised and still hadn't decided how to handle.
Do you know of anyone else who's replaying, as you call it? Asked a cynical voice in the third row.
Pamela glanced at Jeff, then spoke up emphatically before he had a chance to answer. Yes, she said. A man named Stuart McCowan in Seattle, Washington.
There was a momentary pause as 100 pens scratched the name on 100 notepads.
Jeff gave Pamela a warning frown, which she ignored.
As far as we know, he's the only other one, she went on. We spent most of one replay searching for others, but McCowan is the only one we ever verified. Let me tell you, though, that he has some ideas about all this with which we strongly disagree. That's why he's not here with us today. But I think you might find it very interesting to interview him, even keep close track of everything he does, to see how he deals with this situation that the three of us find ourselves in. He's an unusual man, to say the least.
She looked back at Jeff, and he complimented her with a pleased smile. She had said nothing libelous or incriminating about McCowan, but had made sure his background would be thoroughly investigated and his every public move watched from now on. He'd kill no more, not this time.
What do you expect to get out of all this? Asked another reporter. Is this some kind of money-making scheme you're launching, some sort of cult?
Absolutely not, Jeff said firmly. We can make all the money we need or want through ordinary investment channels, and I would like each of your stories to include our specific request that no one send us money, not in any amount, not for any purpose. We will return all such gifts. The only thing we're seeking is information, a possible explanation of what we're going through and how it will all end. We would like the scientific establishment, particularly physicists and cosmologists, to be aware of the reality of what's happening to us, and to contact us directly with any opinions they might have. That's our sole purpose in making this phenomenal situation a matter of public record. We've never revealed ourselves before and wouldn't have now, but for the very real concerns we've outlined.
The room buzzed with skepticism. Everybody was selling something, as Pamela had once pointed out. It was difficult for this collection of hardened journalists to accept the fact that Jeff and Pamela weren't pulling a scam of one sort or another, despite the couple's apparent sincerity and the irrefutable evidence of their inconceivably accurate foreknowledge.
"Then what do you intend to do if you're not trying to capitalize on these claims?" someone else asked.
"It depends on what we find out as a result of having announced ourselves this way," Jeff replied. "For the time being, we're just going to wait and see what happens when you make our story known. Now, are there any further questions?" If not, I have here a number of copies of our newest set of, predictions, as you think of them."
There was a scramble for the front of the room, a multitude of hands grabbing for the Xeroxed sheets of paper, a new outburst of more pointed questions.
"Is there going to be a nuclear war? Will we beat the Russians to the moon?
Do we find a cure for cancer?"
"Sorry," Jeff shouted. "No questions about the future. Everything we have to say is in this document."
"One last question,"
called a bespectacled man in a fedora that looked as if it had been sat on.
"Who's going to win the Kentucky Derby this Saturday?"
Jeff grinned, relaxed for the first time since the tension-filled news conference had begun.
"I'll make a single exception for this gentleman," he said. "Majestic Prince will win the Derby and the Preakness, but Arts and Letters will beat him out of the Triple Crown. And I think I just made my own bet worthless by telling you that."
Majestic Prince left the gate at 1-10 odds and paid $2.10 to win, the lowest return permissible under the laws governing parimutuel gambling. After the story on Jeff and Pamela had hit the networks and the wire services, almost no one had bet on any of the other horses in the Derby. The Kentucky State Racing Commission ordered a full investigation, and there was talk in Maryland and New York of canceling the upcoming Preakness and Belmont. The phones in their new office in the Pan Am building began ringing at 6 a.m. on the Monday after the race. By noon, they had hired two more temps from Kelly Girls to handle the calls and telegrams and the curiosity seekers who walked through the door without an appointment.
"I have the list from the past hour, sir,"
said the awestruck young woman in the pleated midi dress, nervously fingering her long strands of beads.
"Can you summarize it for me?" Jeff asked, wearily, setting aside the editorial in that day's New York Times,
the one calling for rational skepticism in the face of would-be modern Nostradamuses and their manipulation of coincidence.
"Yes, sir. There were 42 requests for private consultations. People who are seriously ill, parents of missing children, and so on. 9 stock brokerage firms called, offering to take you on as clients at reduced commission. We've had 12 calls and 8 telegrams from people willing to put up money for various gambling schemes. 11 messages from other psychics wanting to share..."
"We aren't psychics, Miss, Kendall, is it?"
"Yes, sir. Elaine, if you like."
"Fine. I want that clearly understood, Elaine. Pamela and I don't claim to have any psychic powers, and anyone who makes that assumption should be informed otherwise. This is something very different, and if you're going to work here, you have to know how we choose to be represented."
"I understand, sir. It's just that..."
"It's a little hard for you to accept, of course. I didn't say you had to believe us yourself. Just make sure the basic elements of what we've had to say don't get twisted around when you talk to the public, that's all. Now, go on with the list."
The girl smoothed her blouse, referred to her stenopad.
"There were 11, I suppose you'd call them hate calls. Some of them obscene."
"You don't have to put up with that. Tell the other girls they can feel free to hang up on anyone who becomes abusive. Contact the police if any one caller persists."
"Thank you, sir. We've also had several calls from some futurist group in California. They want you to go out there for a conference with them."
Jeff raised an interested eyebrow.
"The Rand Corporation?"
She glanced back down at her notes.
"No, sir. Something called the Outlook Group."
"Pass it on to my attorney. Ask him to have them checked out. See if they're legitimate."
Elaine jotted his instructions on her pad, went back to the list.
"As long as I'm talking to Mr. Wade, I need to tell him about all these airlines that are threatening to sue. Aeronaves de Mexico, Allegheny Airlines, Philippine Airlines, Air France, Olympic Airways. Also both the Mississippi and Ohio State Tourist Boards, their lawyers called. They're all very angry, sir. I just thought I should warn you."
Jeff nodded distractedly.
"That's it?" he asked.
"Yes, sir, except for a few more magazines all trying to arrange an exclusive interview with you or Miss Phillips, or both."
"Any scholarly journals among them?"
She shook her head.
"The National Enquirer, Fate. I guess you could say the most serious of them was Esquire."
"Still no word from any of the universities? No research foundations other than this outfit in California, whatever it may be?"
"No, sir, that's the whole list."
"All right." He sighed. "Thank you, Elaine. Keep me posted."
"I will, sir."
She folded her pad, started to go, then paused.
"Mr. Winston, I was just wondering..."
"Yes?"
"Do you think I ought to get married? I mean, I've been thinking about it. My boyfriend's asked me twice, but I'd like to know... well, I'd like to know whether it would work out or not."
Jeff smiled tolerantly, saw the desperate desire for foresight in the young woman's eyes.
"I wish I knew," he told her. "But that's something you're going to have to discover for yourself."
Aeronaves de Mexico dropped its lawsuit on June 5th, the day after one of its jetliners crashed into a mountainside near Monterey, as Jeff and Pamela had predicted. Mexican political leader Carlos Madrazo and tennis star Rafael Osuna were not on board the plane in which they had died 5 times before. Only 11 people had seen fit to take the doomed flight this time, not 79. After that, of the remaining airlines for whom disaster had been foretold, only Air Algérie and Royal Nepal Airlines chose to ignore the warning and not cancel the flights in question. Those 2 companies suffered the only fatal accidents in all of the world's commercial aviation for the rest of 1969. The U.S. Navy refused to bow to what Defense Secretary Laird called superstition, and the destroyer Evans proceeded on course in the South China Sea, but the Australian government quietly ordered its aircraft carrier Melbourne to cut engines and drop anchor for the first week of June, and the collision that had always sliced the Evans in half never happened. The death toll in the 4th of July Lake Erie floods in northern Ohio was down from 41 to 5, as residents heeded the highly publicized alerts and sought higher ground before the storms hit. A similar situation prevailed in Mississippi. Tourist bookings at the Gulf Coast resorts of Gulfport and Biloxi were down to almost nothing for mid-August, and the local populace fled inland at a rate never before achieved by mere civil defense warnings. Hurricane Camille struck a nearly deserted coastline, and 138 of her previous 149 victims survived. Lives changed. Lives went on where they had never continued before. And the world took note.
"I want an injunction filed now, Mitchell. This week, if we can. The middle of next, at the latest."
The lawyer concentrated on his glasses, polishing the thick lenses with a precision befitting the care that might be taken with an expensive telescope.
"I don't know, Jeff," he said. "I'm not sure that'll be possible."
"How soon can we get it, then?" asked Pamela.
"We may not be able to," Wade admitted.
"You mean not at all? These people are free to go on spewing their ridiculous fantasies about us, and there's nothing we can do about it?"
The attorney found another invisible spot on one of his lenses, wiped it away delicately with a little square of chamois.
"They may well be acting within their First Amendment rights."
"They're leeching off us!"
Jeff exploded, waving the pamphlet that had prompted this meeting. His photograph was prominent on the cover of the booklet, along with a slightly smaller picture of Pamela.
"They're profiting from our names and our statements, with no authorization from us, and in the process they're making a mockery of everything we've tried to do."
"They are a non-profit organization," Wade reminded him, "and they've filed for tax-exempt status as a religious institution. That kind of thing is hard to fight. It takes years, and the chances for beating them are slim."
"What about the libel laws?" Pamela insisted.
"You've made yourselves public figures. That doesn't leave you with much protection. And I'm not sure their comments about you could be construed as libelous anyway. A jury might even see it as the opposite extreme. These people worship you. They believe you're the incarnation of God on earth. I think you're better off just ignoring them. Legal action would only give them more publicity."
Jeff made a wordless exclamation of disgust, crumpled the pamphlet in one hand, and threw it toward the far corner of his office.
"This is just the kind of thing we wanted to avoid," he said, fuming. "Even if we ignore it or deny it, it taints us by association. No reputable scientific organization is going to want to have anything to do with us after this."
The lawyer slipped his glasses back on, adjusted them on the bridge of his nose with one thick forefinger.
"I understand your dilemma," he told them, "but I don't..."
The intercom on Jeff's desk buzzed in two short bursts, followed by a single long one, the signal he had established for notification of an urgent message.
"Yes, Elaine?"
"There's a gentleman here to see you, sir. He says he's with the federal government."
"What branch? Civil defense? The National Science Foundation?"
"Well, the State Department, sir. He insists on speaking with you personally, you and Miss Phillips both."
"Jeff?" Wade frowned. "Want me to sit in on this?"
"Maybe," Jeff told him. "Let's see what he wants."
Jeff keyed the intercom again.
"Show him in, Elaine."
The man she brought into the office was in his mid-40s, balding, with alert blue eyes and nicotine-stained fingers. He sized up Jeff with a quick, penetrating glance, did the same to Pamela, then looked at Mitchell Wade.
"I'd prefer we have this talk in private," the man said.
Wade stood, introduced himself.
"I'm Mr. Winston's attorney," he said. "I also represent Miss Phillips."
The man pulled a thin billfold from his jacket pocket, handed Wade and Jeff his card.
"Russell Hedges, U.S. Department of State. I'm afraid the nature of what I have to discuss here is confidential. Would you mind, Mr. Wade?"
"Yes, I would mind. My clients have a right to—"
"No legal advice is required in this situation," Hedges said. "This concerns a matter of national security."
The attorney started to protest once more, but Jeff stopped him.
"It's all right, Mitchell. I'd like to hear him out. Think over what we were talking about before, and let me know if you come up with any workable alternatives. I'll give you a call tomorrow."
"Call me today if you need to," Wade said,
casting a scowl at the government representative.
I'll be in my office late, probably till 6 or 6:30.
Oh, thanks. We'll get in touch if necessary.
Mind if I smoke?
Hedges asked, pulling out a pack of Camels as the lawyer left the room.
Go right ahead.
Jeff motioned him to one of the seats facing the desk and slid an ashtray within his reach. Hedges produced a box of wooden matches, lit his cigarette with one. He let the match burn slowly to a blackened stub, which he dropped, still smoldering, into the large glass ashtray.
Now, we've been aware of you, of course, Hedges said at length. Difficult not to be, what with the media spotlight you've been in for the past 4 months. Though I must admit, most of my colleagues have tended to dismiss your pronouncements as parlor tricks until this week.
Libya?
Jeff asked, knowing the answer. Hedges nodded, took a long drag from the cigarette.
Everyone at the Middle East desk is still thunderstruck. Our most reliable intelligence assessments indicated King Idris had a thoroughly stable regime. You not only named the date of the coup, you specified that the junta would come from the middle echelons of the Libyan army. I want you to tell me how you knew all that.
I've already explained it as clearly as I'm able.
This business about reliving your life.
His cool gaze took in Pamela.
Your lives. You can't expect us to believe that, can you?
You don't have any choice, Jeff said matter-of-factly.
Neither do we. It's happening, that's all we know. The only reason we've made such a spectacle of ourselves this time is because we want to find out more about it. I've made all this very plain before.
I expected you'd say that.
Pamela leaned forward intently. Surely there are government researchers who could investigate this phenomenon. Help us find the answers we're looking for.
That's not my department.
But you could direct us to them. Let them know you're taking us seriously. There are physicists who might...
In exchange for what?
Hedges asked, flicking a long ash from his cigarette. I beg your pardon?
You're talking about a commitment of funds, manpower, laboratory facilities. What would we get in return?
Pamela pursed her lips, looked at Jeff. Information, she said after a moment's pause. Advanced knowledge of events that will upset the world's economy and lead to the deaths of thousands of innocent people. Hedges crushed out the cigarette, his keen blue eyes riveted on hers.
Such as?
She glanced at Jeff again. His face held no expression, neither approval nor admonishment. This thing in Libya, Pamela told Hedges, will have disastrous, far-reaching consequences. The man in charge of the junta, Colonel Gaddafi, will appoint himself premier early next year. He's a madman, the most truly evil figure of the next 20 years. He'll turn Libya into a breeding ground and a haven for terrorists. Dreadful, unimaginable things will happen because of him. Hedges shrugged.
That's awfully vague, he said. It could be years before those kinds of assertions are proven or disproven. Besides, we're more interested in events in Southeast Asia, not the ups and downs of these little Arab states.
Pamela shook her head decisively. You're wrong there. Vietnam is a lost cause. It's the Middle East that'll be the pivotal region during the next 2 decades. The man looked at her thoughtfully, fished another cigarette from his crumpled pack.
There's a minority faction of state that's expressed just that opinion, he said. But when you claim our stance in Vietnam is hopeless, what about the death of Ho Chi Minh the day before yesterday? Won't that weaken the resolve of the NLF? Our analysts say,
Jeff spoke up.
If anything, it'll strengthen their determination. Ho will be all but canonized, made into a martyr. They'll rename Saigon after him, and once they've taken the city.
You were about to name a date,
Hedges said, squinting at him through a haze of smoke.
I think we should be somewhat selective about what we tell you, Jeff said carefully, giving Pamela a cautioning look. We don't want to add to the world's troubles, just help it avert some of the clear-cut misfortunes.
I don't know. There are still a number of doubting Thomases in the department, and if all you can offer are evasive generalities,
Kosygin and Cho En La, Jeff declared forcefully. They'll meet in Peking next week, and early next month, the Soviet Union and China will agree to hold formal talks on their border disputes.
Hedges frowned in disbelief.
Kosygin would never visit China.
He will, Jeff asserted with a tight smile. And before too long, so will Richard Nixon.
The March wind off Chesapeake Bay stirred the light rain into a fine, chill mist, stopped the scattered droplets in their fall, and whipped them this way and that into an atmospheric microcosm of the whitecaps that slapped across the choppy bay. Jeff's hooded slicker glistened blackly in the omnipresent moisture as the cold, clear drizzle lashed and trickled invigoratingly across his face.
"What about Allende?"
Hedges asked, trying without success to light a sodden camel.
"Does he stand a chance? You mean despite your people's mucking about in Chilean politics?"
It had long since become obvious to Jeff and Pamela that Russell Hedges had only the most tenuous connection to the State Department. Whether he was CIA or NSA or something else entirely, they didn't know. It didn't really matter. The end results were the same. Hedges gave one of his ambiguous half-smiles, managed to get the cigarette going.
"You don't have to tell me whether he's actually going to be elected or not, just whether he stands a reasonable chance. And if I say he does, then what? He goes the way of Gaddafi? This country had nothing to do with the Gaddafi assassination. I've told you that time and again. It was purely an internal Libyan affair. You know how those third-world power struggles go."
There was no point arguing about it with the man again. Jeff knew damned well that Gaddafi had been killed before ever taking office as a direct result of what he and Pamela had told Hedges of the dictator's future policies and actions. Not that Jeff mourned the death of a bloodthirsty maniac like that, but it was widely assumed that the CIA was linked to the murder. And those well-founded rumors had led to the creation of a previously non-existent terrorist outfit called the November Squad, headed by Gaddafi's younger brother. The group had vowed a lifetime of revenge in the name of its slain leader. Already a massive petroleum fire raged out of control in the desert south of Tripoli, where 3 months earlier the November Squad had blown up a mobile oil installation, killing 11 Americans and 23 Libyan employees. Chile's Allende was no Gaddafi. He was a decent, well-meaning man, the first freely elected Marxist president in history. He would die soon enough as it was, and probably at American instigation. Jeff had no intention of hurrying that shameful day. "I have nothing to say about Allende one way or the other. He's no threat to the United States. Let's just leave it at that." Hedges tried to draw on the soggy cigarette, but it had gone out again, and the wet paper had begun to split. He threw it off the wharf and into the restless water with dismay.
"You had no such compunctions about telling us Heath will be elected prime minister in England this summer."
Jeff eyed him sardonically.
"Maybe I wanted to make sure you didn't decide to have Harold Wilson shot." "God damn it," Hedges spat out. "Who set you up as the moral arbiter of U.S. foreign policy? It's your job to supply us with advance information, period. Let the people in charge decide what's important, what's not, and how to handle it."
"I've seen the results of some of those decisions before," Jeff said. "I prefer to remain selective about what I reveal. Besides," he added, "this was supposed to be a fair trade. What about your end of the bargain? Is any progress being made?"
Hedges coughed, turned his back to the wind off the bay.
"Why don't we go back inside, have a warm drink?"
"I like it out here," Jeff said defiantly. "It makes me feel alive."
"Well, I'll be dead of pneumonia if we stay out here much longer. Come on, let's go in. I'll tell you what the scientists have had to say so far."
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.